Hello and welcome to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast that attempts to get to the particular people behind the positions that shape our public conversations. Every week I speak to someone who has some kind of public voice or public platform, and I ask them to share what is sacred to them, their deepest principles and the values that they try and live by. I'm digging, in one sense, for their ethics, their worldview, what they think a good life is about, although we might not always use those kind of philosophy seminar terms for them. I want to understand their story and their influences and approach them, no matter where they are coming from, with curiosity, ideally empathy, not adversarially. I speak to a real range of people. Different political perspectives, different metaphysical beliefs, different professions, in the hope that I, and by extension we, can build understanding about people who share our common life, but who may be very unlike ourselves. So my encouragement is always not to just cherry pick the episodes that you already know are guests that you're going to be interested in, and by all means, start there. You know, check us out, see if it's a podcast that is worth your time and attention. Once you've kind of oriented yourself, I would encourage you to also listen to the people that you might instinctively find more challenging. And notice that those that you find more challenging are often the people who you don't have anything in common with or who you don't aspire to be. People who don't reflect us back at ourselves. I really do think listening across our differences is magic. It's good for us as citizens. It's good for our souls, in my language. And as a bonus, I can promise you, it's usually really interesting. People are so complex and unique. They are very rarely entirely what we expect them to be. Almost every guest I have approached with a sense of prejudices and presuppositions, and they have surprised me. And that is a really enjoyable sensation. So I invite you to come on an adventure with me. And today's adventure is with our guest, Freddie Sayers. Freddie is the editor-in-chief and CEO of Unheard, which is an online news site and magazine if you've not come across it. He was previously editor-in-chief of YouGov, which is a major polling agency, and the founder of Politics Home. We spoke about a bunch of things, as usual. We spoke about his sacred value of beauty, his unconventional path into political journalism via acting, mainly playing very royal roles, why he began to question some of the underlying logic and culture of liberalism, but now finds himself politically very difficult to describe. We spoke about questioning the wisdom of lockdowns and how you navigate being someone who wants to be unorthodox and questioning without letting that very unorthodoxy itself hardened into certainties and tribalism. There are some reflections from me at the end, as usual, and I really hope you enjoy listening. Freddie, we are going to start deep, as we mean to go on, which is asking you about what is sacred to you. And you can take this in any direction you like. You can push back. You can reject the word. If guardrails are helpful, I think of it as a way of surfacing our deep values and principles, the things that we want to define our life. You've had a little bit of time. What's bubbled up for you around that word, that concept?
Well, I'm not very accustomed to answering the questions. In my most recent job, I've mainly been asking them, which is an easier task. So in preparation for this, it's been an interesting process. And I think it's a good question that you ask, what are your sacred values? If I think back to my upbringing and my childhood and what has sort of defined me, it's a bit of a paradox because there was very little religion in my upbringing, in my life. There was actually very little politics either. But it did feel like there was a lot that was sacred. We had a very big sense of the sacred, I feel, in my family. And the word which I'm about to use is easy to kind of miscast or misinterpret, but I would say one of the top values that united our family was beauty. Might be a surprising one to come from me, but we had a farm. We still have a kind of farmhouse in Sweden. My mother is Swedish. And although we weren't really church-going people, I guess we were theoretically Christian, went for Christmas and so on, but the sense of sacred around Christmas, around summer, Easter, the lighting of candles, the importance of a beautiful kind of sacred home, the high ceremony of dinners and shared meals, the kind of emphasis that we put on the nature and what a beautiful place it was. It's right by a lake. So there was a great deal of sort of wonder in my childhood, which was focused, I think, on this sense of the importance of the beauty and the wonder of life. So although we weren't religious, I would say there was a great sense of a more than material. And so, yes, beauty, I don't know if you've ever had that as a number one value from one of your customers, but that would probably be the first.
No, but I've been waiting for it. I think a lot about truth and goodness and beauty. I think Aquinas' way of thinking about God. And it is really interesting how most people's sacred cluster around truth or goodness. And
I feel it's a sort of unfashionable value in a way. It sounds superficial to the modern ear. Mm. It's almost a bit of an embarrassing word to use. It's supposed to be the most subjective. And it's sort of mixed up with the ideas of taste and things like that, which I don't think is what it's about. In the kind of deeper sense, I do think it is a important value.
I did a whole master's in theology and the arts specifically because I felt like there was some kind of apologetic from beauty that we had missed. So I am not at all offended or surprised, but you're right. It's not a common one to surface.
That the book that probably kind of crystallized this for me, in my strange and circuitous journey to doing what I do now, I had a moment after I left YouGov, which was one of my previous companies. I joined a Plato class and we did this weekly. It was an amazing period. We did a weekly reading with, I think it was 12 of us, literally line by line. And we started with the Symposium, which is very much about beauty. I found that a very crystallizing and important period because for me, it felt very radical that ideas and values could be considered completely real rather than purely subjective. The good and the true and the beautiful as sort of lodestars that are out there in the cosmos that we need to try to orient ourselves towards. I found a very just clarifying and important step in my journey. I would put beauty up there. I'm going to throw one more at you to get this conversation going if I could, which I don't know if you've had either, which is conversation. If I'm thinking of my family and my life as a younger person, we were always talking. And very lively, very, this is a polite way of putting it, hot occasionally, but always sort of sincere and engaged conversation.
You've got lots of siblings.
I have a nearly twin sister who is 11 months older than me. So we're born between two Christmases. We both...
Your poor mother.
...appeared, yeah. We were so close that we almost could finish each other's sentences and still can. And also both quite argumentative. And it got to the... It's almost like having a sort of mirror reflection where you know what the opposing argument is going to be and you're sort of three arguments ahead of each other. So even now, I'm 42, she's 43, we will call each other up and and it'll be, I know what you're going to say, but so around our dinner table, I have a wonderful half brother as well. And my two parents, they're also very, very different. Mm. My father is a criminal QC, or was, so very much a forensic way of thinking, what your former guest Ian McGilchrist would call left brain, focused, rational, logical. And my mother is the exact opposite. She is much more, I would say, extremely intuitive, much more interested in the widest possible perspective, the biggest ideas, the mystical, the facts and some specific arguments she finds quite irrelevant. So we as a family kind of move between these two poles. And it meant that our conversations were always always interesting and always sort of evolving. So everyone was, you know, there was no clear dogma. There was no clear sense of this is our family cosmology. Everyone needs to fit into it. Everything was always up for negotiation and everything was moving. And I think that I really have carried forward the sense that you need to talk things through to get at the truth. And it can't be laid down in a tablet.
And how would you... We know that you were comfortable with kind of argument and conversation, but how else would you describe yourself? If I had met you, say, age 9, how would I kind of report back on this little boy that I'd met?
I think I was probably a complete monster. extremely precocious, probably quite pleased with myself, good at talking. After all these years of preparation around the family dinner table. So... very comfortable with adults, probably quite spooky to adults because I would sort of immediately engage them on adult topics. So yeah, I probably don't like the memory of myself very much, age 9. You know, going to those London schools as well. I went to a private school in London, very cerebral, lots of banter. And
boys' school again, or mixed?
It was boys. Yeah. So, yeah, that sense of constantly talking your way through the day. And I think, well, here I am, still talking.
Did you have, politics has been one of the threads in your very interesting journey. Did you have a kind of dawning political awakening, a sense of ideas that were becoming relevant to you, or did that did that come later?
I think it came a lot later. I grew up in what is now called the end of history period.
Oh, yes, we remember that.
With a barbed reference to Francis Fukuyama's book, because famously it wasn't the end of history. History very much started again. But actually, I think he was onto something, which is that that sort of 90s, 2000s era, even though it didn't turn out to be like that, did feel like the many of the great questions had been settled. And if you grew up in that era like I did, it didn't feel like you were in a mobile political moment where, you know, things were potentially going to go wrong or
would need renegotiating.
No, it was sort of done deal.
We've arrived.
And I mean, I'm sure there'll be lots of people who are my age who had a different experience, but my experience of university as well, completely alien to what I read about today on university campuses. It was bizarrely unpolitical. Everyone was worried about all of the usual young things, about, you know, what the next party was and a bit occasionally your studies, I suppose. But who was cool and what you were planning to do next week. I wasn't involved in a political movement at all. My sort of awakening, if that's the right word, radicalization, I sometimes... jokingly referred to it as, was much later. It was much more in the last 10 years, to be honest.
You came out of university and patching this chronology together is tricky because you're a very private person, but which I'm respecting, but also pushing on. Modeling and acting, was that where you went after graduation first?
Modeling, I'm taking that as a compliment, but no, I never did any of that.
Okay.
I like that. I think I once was a hand model, bizarrely. I did it. At one point, there was a picture of my hands holding a Nintendo on bus stops in London, but I'm not even sure how that happened. I did a little bit of childhood, young person acting.
Yeah.
Very forgettable. Mm-hmm. Was hopeless. They kept giving me parts, which was really bad because I then did them and then watched myself and I was like, oh no.
Yeah.
This is not my gift to the world.
How has this occurred?
There was then a TV film about the Musketeers in which I played King Louis XIV. I'm blushing.
That
even
sounds really fun,
this.
Though.
It was fun. It was during my finals at university, yeah. So it was quite intense. But it filmed in Croatia.
Wow.
And Gerard Depardieu was my evil advisor, Cardinal Mazarin.
What a laugh. And did you have to learn to fence?
I didn't get much fencing, no. It was more, I would sort of waft around the palace, fretting about things. But the costume people were very determined to follow the original Louis XIV clothing, so they gave me 3-inch clogs, which he famously introduced as the high fashion because he was smaller. I'm 6'4½, so... When I teetered onto set in my 3-inch clogs, the whole set went silent.
And the cinematographer was like, this is not going to work.
This is not going to work.
If I get his head, I can't get anyone else's head.
So I watched that back and thought, you know, don't do any more of this. So I left that behind.
Okay.
I talked about conversation and beauty at the start of this, and actually all of the strange collection of things that I've done since have sort of veered between those two. There's always been one foot in politics and media.
Mm.
And yes, another foot in quite
clogs and
unrelated things. I mean, I did a hotel and a nightclub in my early 20s.
I think at some point what comes next is what I have down in my notes is the Clinton chapter. And you're just going to have to explain how that occurred and what it was.
I feel like 2016... when Hillary lost the second time.
Yeah.
You know, that came for me at the end of quite an intense, well, for many of us, that was the year, wasn't it? I mean, that was the year where the world started to really shift, it feels like.
Mm.
And for me, I really began thinking differently about the world during that year. Began earlier than the November presidential election. It began, like many of us here, at the Brexit moment.
Yeah.
And I was, at that time, at YouGov, the polling company.
Yeah.
And all of the evidence we were coming up with for Brexit was pretty much 50-50. I mean, all the polls were 51-49, or it was going in each direction. And yet, the certainty in the media, in the financial markets, that Brexit wasn't going to happen was so bizarre to me.
Yeah.
And it really just made me realize that the power of groupthink, the power of willful logic.
Yeah.
You know, there were extremely elaborate reasons given for why it was definitely not going to happen. I remember, you know, there were articles in newspapers describing why one particular set of polls done by telephone was correct as opposed to the ones that were done on the internet.
Yeah.
All of which was just made up. It just wasn't true.
Yeah. It was the confabulation of trying to make what we were seeing line up with what we already thought.
That's right. And so, you know, observing that and all of these people who were in charge of the world.
Yeah.
Believing things that were so quickly shown to be untrue.
Yeah.
And in fact, those people who were most educated and most sophisticated in their reasoning were the ones who were most wrong.
Yeah.
So I really began to question who's right and who's wrong and who should you trust in these kind of big discussions during that year. And then, of course, the November 2016 experience really finish it off because there, again, everyone thought Hillary was going to win.
Yeah.
Including, of course, the Hillary campaign.
Yeah.
And their reliance on data, the degree to which they believed the polls.
Yeah.
You know, they had extraordinary amounts of very, very sophisticated looking numbers all the time. Yeah. We were getting daily polls from each state down to decimal points about how definitely it was going to go. And it wasn't right.
Yeah.
So for me, you know, the relative emphasis I put on intuition and spidey senses over elaborate evidence of the kinds that people were relying on in 2016 shifted forever that year.
And was it a kind of also a sense of shifting political? Would you have described yourself as a liberal prior to that and that had changed? Or was it more about sort of those authority structures and legitimacy structures for you?
I still don't describe myself politically.
Mm.
Because it's evolving.
I'm so confused most of the time.
I was before COVID, I was definitely interested in the set of ideas that are sometimes called post-liberal.
Yeah.
I think the critique that post-liberal thinkers and who come from the left and the right make of liberalism is an interesting and powerful one.
Yeah.
That in a way, like what we've just been talking about, that liberalism has made inadequate account of those deeper intuitions and needs of people.
Yeah.
And whether they are tribe or nation or religion or purpose.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of lost its way.
Yeah.
And needs correcting, I think, is basically right. But then the post-liberal solutions offered, I don't find at all convincing. And then my COVID experience, which happened soon after that, was another big shift in the way that I saw the world. And you know, we should probably spend some time on that, because that was a big deal for me. And has definitely tilted me back in the direction of valuing freedom and as something that we should be very careful about giving up.
Yeah.
No matter how good the rationale.
Yes. Yes. I want to dig into that unheard and what happened around 2020 and kind of your thinking behind that. Before we get that, I just sort of want to know, what was the thread you were pulling on that got you there through YouGov and then I want to call it politics.co.uk. That's right.
Politics Home.
Politics Home. Forgive me. I knew I was going to get those two confused.
Generic names.
Apologies. Very different. Politics Home. And are you someone who feels a sense of vocation? Did you have a right, this is what I'm going to do in the world. I'm going to be involved in politics and journalism and public life, and I'm going to do something good. Is it more, you know, opportunities arise and they sound interesting? What is motivating you when you're making the decisions about what to be doing with your professional life?
I've always been quite reactive in a way. I definitely have inherited the more intuitive
your mother.
Mode of making decisions from my mum. So I respond to how I feel at different moments.
Yeah.
And 2016, I had a very sudden feeling after that I didn't want to be an observer during this momentous period.
Could call it the beginning of history, the restarting of history.
I mean, you can argue about when that restarted, but it was definitely up and running again.
Yes, it was.
And yeah, I just felt there was so much misunderstanding and so much that sort of cross boy around the dinner table when someone makes a crappy argument and you feel like you need to fight back on it was really riled up in 2016. So many people talking such a lot of nonsense, and the whole idea that you would demonize half the population, which happened here during Brexit and then happened again in the US when Trump was elected, I thought was morally horrific, but also logically stupid. The idea that we meet people from the other half of the population every day, and they're usually wonderful people. Of course they're not demons. And so I really felt like the world was going mad during that year, and that people who could speak the language like I could of the quote unquote metropolitan elites, liberal elites, needed to get activated to push back on some of their excesses.
Yeah.
Frankly.
Yeah.
It was my own class that were most responsible for that mood, I feel like, not the Brexit voters or the Trump voters.
Yeah.
It was the response, which was so over the top.
Yeah.
So I really felt I needed to fight against them.
Yeah.
And that then led me to Unheard.
Yeah. And when you took over, it had been established for a few years, but it was nothing sort of like the reach that it is now. What was the vision that you and Paul Marshall and others involved had for it? What were you trying to build?
I think somewhere that could question some of these orthodoxies without going down the rabbit hole and becoming either kind of swivel-eyed, furious, reactionary, or conspiracy adjacent, or all of these things that are, you know, often misused but sometimes quite real.
Yeah.
To provide intelligent, thoughtful critiques of some of the over-dominant orthodoxies was the impulse. And for me, it was completely the dream job because that's what I like to do anyway. So the contrarian in me was very attracted to it. It's been a huge privilege and great fun to see it grow. And it now, you know, we now have millions of readers. We have more readers in the US than the UK. We've now opened this club and restaurant attached in London, and it, God knows what the next steps will be, but it felt like it was the right thing at the right time. And a lot of people like me were not happy with the public conversation from 2016 onwards and needed something better.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure we don't get everything right. And there might be many people listening who have read something they don't like on Unheard. That's fine. But, you know, we do our best to provide different perspectives.
I'm fascinated. You know, you talked about, I spent some time at the BBC and was never very senior there, but what I was particularly fascinated by was that editorial decision-making. These fine-grained, discerning judgments, you know, between how do I know I'm not just getting swept up in groupthink? How do I know I'm not being contrarian for the sake of it? You know, I'm fascinated by, I guess, you know, internal culture, but you in particular, what have you used as you're making those decisions? You know, you guys got hit by this, the COVID thing came about, and for a while it felt like you were the only place that was offering different perspectives on lockdowns, that was creating space for people who had queries about vaccines, you know, that it became a place where a lot of people clustered, right? I think. But that hadn't, you know, that wasn't, you didn't know that was coming. That wasn't what you said. Didn't brand yourself as like, this is the place to come if you want to think through these things. How did you navigate that editorially, philosophically, ethically? Where did you find, it's a very incoherent question, but where did you go looking for wisdom as you and the team sought to navigate your way through that? Which, as you said, there's like big ditches to fall in on either side and all around.
Well, editorially, we have a great editorial team. There's a wonderful editor called Sally Chatterton, who is brilliant, and we collaborate very closely on every article that is published. The COVID thing was kind of my obsession. I mean, I suppose we all were obsessed with it when we weren't allowed to leave our homes because of it. But the truth is, I just had a very strong reaction to the idea that suddenly we could shut down all of society and force people to remain in their homes on the basis of so many unknowns. So I never doubted that that was wrong, actually. We tried, you know, we included all perspectives, and I really did my best when quizzing people who are either in favor of the measures or against them to put the opposing arguments. But the whole way that decision was arrived at to shut down pretty much the entire world, I think should be rightly studied for decades. And my view, I don't think this is a secret, is that it was the wrong one. You know, I'm, as we've talked about, I'm half Swedish. Didn't happen in Sweden. I went to Sweden in May, June, or thereabouts in 2020, and it was like a completely different universe. Everyone was going about their business. Of course, there were cautions and people weren't exactly the same as normal, but it was an open, normal society, and the levels of sick people were in no, by no means higher. So I just had this very strong sense that there was another way to do it. You know, we had some interviews that launched the YouTube channel where we spoke to actually some Swedish scientists, very senior, convincing, good epidemiologists who were like, well, no one's ever done this before, locking people down. It's not a scientific approach. There have been very small examples of shutdowns in small parts of cities, but no one's ever tried to shut the whole world down. It's a sort of outrageously reckless, ambitious project. It's never happened before. I don't think it, in all of history, it's never happened. And yet that very same tone, which was educated people sneering at people who disagreed or questioned it as proletariat imbeciles, basically, peasants with pitchforks who didn't understand the science and were a danger, was very much a continuation of that Brexit-y mood. And I thought it was just completely outrageous. And not only on the evidence, which I now think we have quite a lot of, and I have to share my killer statistic here. I know it's not the topic of your podcast, but in case anyone is interested, Sweden, after these 3.5 years, the only country in Europe that never did a lockdown, has at least either the lowest or second lowest excess death numbers of that 3-year period of all 28 countries in Europe. So for me, the evidence is there, and people just aren't accepting it. But, you know, how, why I reacted so strongly, it pushed all of those buttons of unfairness, high-handedness, and a deep misunderstanding to me about what was important about life, because the logic of those lockdowns was that there was only one metric that was worthwhile, and that was infections and deaths from COVID. And everything else in the vast tapestry of life receded in service of those metrics. So it was this sort of ultra technocrat view and sort of utilitarianism gone wild. And so myopic somehow. And all of those things that didn't come up, didn't show on charts. My parents, who are getting older, suddenly being stuck in their house for month after month, you know, visibly diminishing, not being able to live their normal active lives. Many, you know, happily, my parents have recovered from that, but I know that many, many people didn't. And all of, you know, young people's education, the beauty, frankly, of life, the purpose of life was just ignored in favor of a very strictly utilitarian calculus, which became tyrannical. And I think it's a real lesson of how thinking can go wrong and how dangerous educated people can be when they have very narrow values.
It felt to me like a sort of, I started the podcast after 2016 because it felt like this thing that should have been a reasonably technical question about borders and governance and, you know, these things that only really nerds in European politics should be interested in, became something sacred, became about a clash of opposing visions and opposing values. And COVID felt the same, that the, you know, I'm aware when I think about what's sacred that they can, that it can play either these, this kind of unifying, steadying, rooting role in our lives, or dividing and everything else goes in service to the thing that's sacred and you can't see beyond it. Mm. But looking back on that time and how triggered we were, even so, we live in a small community house and we were navigating different risk tolerances within our house, different tribes in which we were embedded, some medical tribes, some other tribes, you know, the ability to love each other across those disagreements whilst potentially putting each other at risk was, we were able to do it because we had already covenanted and committed together and we were forced into the same physical space. But when you remove all those conditions, it became almost impossible, I think, to understand each other. Did you lose friends? Was there a kind of emotional component within your own tribes and your own relationships?
There were definitely raised eyebrows that I was asking all these questions. Mm. A lot of those people who were most critical have quietened down in the years subsequent, I think it's become more acceptable over time to think that mistakes were made during that period. But I think what you say about turning people against each other is exactly right. And that's why it was so scary, because by inserting this fear of each other into the heart of the conversation, it sort of inverted what is our greatest superpower as a species, which is our ability to form societies and to work together to build relationships, into a negative. Yeah. So that the very thing that was making us strong was sort of turned into making us weak. And I think it was a very frightening period, which I think a lot of people have not recovered from. I know that the number of people who philosophically have changed their worldview since that, those years, 2020, 2021, is very great. People who now just feel alienated, deeply untrustful, whose founding principle is that whatever they're being told is probably not true rather than true. I mean, that group might have been, maybe it was 10% before COVID, and it definitely feels like it's nearer 20 or even 30%. So something very fundamental in our societies was broken during that period.
When you think of, I'm always so nervous asking this to people who are sort of journalist or journalist adjacent, because it's very earnest, but I feel like you can tolerate it.
Hit me with it.
Yeah. What is a good media platform for? You know, if and I know enough about you to know you know, you said you didn't want to stand on the sidelines. You wanted to be involved in the world that we build together, in our common life, in our public conversations. And the level of power that media platforms have, less so than in the past, because we've had this diversification and fracturing of outlets. It's not like, you know, everyone's going to read the editorial in the Times and 70% of the country will just adopt that as their opinion. But there is a sense in which these platforms, commentators and columnists are incepting ideas into people's minds, right? They offer that we can't have an opinion on everything. So we just take a lot of opinion secondhand because we haven't got the RAM to agree with it, to research it and come to our own conclusions. What is it that you're trying to do? What is a great kind of opinions-based, news-based media platform doing? On your deathbed and you look back, what would you love to be able to say about Unheard and the role it played in public life and public conversations? And if you want to just pivot to, you can see what I mean, it's a very earnest question. But
I think it wants to be about keeping the conversation open and useful. And at least Unheard specifically, this probably doesn't apply to all media platforms, but our role I see as a corrective force. That when the groupthink starts gaining momentum and the stampede begins, you know, we need to be there asking the difficult questions and bringing credible senior people in to make sure it's socially and politically acceptable to ask those questions. So I think that's our role. But I think generally no media should be didactic, frankly. And I think what we have at the moment, you mentioned a lot of these new media outlets, I think they are just as dangerous as the traditional ones. I really do. So this is the way to get hated from both sides. But I do feel like the quote unquote establishment, whether it's the BBC and the New York Times and the Times, versus the now growing in influence anti-establishment, YouTube channels, new digital publications, Tucker Carlson on X, etc. That is also now a force to be reckoned with. And it very much, although many of them started their journey by, in a similar way to me, rejecting the orthodoxies, wanting to keep the conversation open, they also have found solace with each other.
Yeah.
They amplify each other's voices. And you can see it hardening into a new dogma where there are certain things you can't say.
Yeah.
And there is an element of loyalty.
Yeah.
And it's a new herd, frankly, and it's just as dangerous. So I think a good media platform, certainly what we should be doing, is constantly revisiting your priors, constantly trying to stay open-minded, and do your very best not to just join a new gang that are all violently agreeing with each other. Yeah. To make themselves feel important.
And one of the spaces I think Unheard has been distinct, one of the questions I think Unheard has been distinctive for creating space for, which didn't feel like there was so much space for in other media platforms in the last few years, is very explicit conversations about religion. Not as a devotional or a religiously oriented publishing platform itself, but as one of the things that people could talk about. Certainly why I pitch stuff to you and write for Unheard sometimes, because it feels like I can be honest about that as part of my ethical framing, as a way that I see the world. How has that come about, and how does that play out personally for you? What kind of interest / intuitions do you have about the moment that we're in?
A lot of our contributors are becoming Christian. I noticed this. A lot of people who were formerly simply searching and were not Christian. I'm thinking of Paul Kingsnorth is a now quite famous example, but Matthew Crawford, a philosopher I really like. Ayaan Hirsi Ali recently announced that she considers herself a Christian. Yeah. She did that Unheard. So Nick Cave, someone we, I'm happy to say, have done quite a lot with. So it's definitely out there. Personally, I am not a Christian. I would be dishonest if I described myself as a Christian. I'm very envious of people who are, but I don't have a faith like that. But I feel very defensive of people with religious belief for kind of the reasons that we've talked about, that outlawing it or pouring scorn on it or trying to tell people that it's nonsense and that we live in an entirely only mechanistic universe and believing anything else is absurd, I think is an outrageous position to have. Like, incredibly dogmatic and illogical and with no humility at all. So I will go to the wall in defense of people with religious belief. And we recently had Richard Dawkins on the show, and we had a bit of a fallout over this. He describes himself as an ultra-Darwinian. In other words, he thinks, which I believe is more so than normal evolutionary biologists, he believes that almost everything about human nature and the body is selected into being by design of natural selection. And so I put to him, what about religious intuition, which is a near universal among human peoples? What, surely that's been selected into being.
Must be good for us.
Serve a purpose by your own logic. It must be good for us. And he sort of conceded that it might be useful at a population level. But he, of course, stopped short of saying he was going to suddenly tear up his life work and embrace religion. But I think it's so important to stay open-minded and also to realize that these deep intuitions that people have may be truer than the kind of surface technocratic explanations that we normally talk about in politics.
Freddie, this is really personal now. But
so I think it's important. So
forgive me for interrupting you, but whenever someone says to me, I'm not a Christian, but I really envy people who are, I always want to be like, you can be. Like, what's stopping me?
I don't know. I don't sort of believe it in the way that I would need to. I'm not actively trying to become a Christian either, I should say. I guess it is quite useful not to be in my particular position right now. But no, I support it. I love church. I love all things about it. I think it's foundational to our culture. I am envious of those people. I suppose I think perhaps they are more open than I am. And that's what I mean when I say I'm envious.
Forgive me if this is an illogical deduction, but if you're envious of it, but you're not actively trying, what is it that, it surely can't be professional risk aversion. I think Unheard wouldn't fall apart if you converted. What is it that, bear in mind I'm unoffendable, so if you can say what's stopping you, there are some good reasons not to pursue it. What do you think yours are?
Well, I guess it's my allergy to overly confidently knowing the answers. So I would also be repelled by it in that same way, I think. I'm envious of those people who have that faculty and feel those things so deeply, but I also would be worried about being overly confident in the answers. I suppose I probably have a little bit of beef with Christianity in particular, in that I think it has led to some unhealthy habits in its, what Tom Holland would argue is the kind of post-Christian secular age. A lot of this strange ideas that are moving around are very much a kind of Christian inheritance, and I think it has a bit of a case to answer on those grounds. But yeah, I like my ever evolving cosmology as it is. So I think I'll stay without the answers for now.
And I will leave you there, except to say, I don't feel that different from you. I don't feel certain ever really. And I have been a Christian and then an attempted atheist and then an agnostic and then a Christian. And I'm going to get boring because I'm always quoting this, but I was on a Radio 3 program recently talking to Dan Dennett. And I said, please, will you go back and read Pascal's Wager? Because it's not what you think it is. It's this beautiful wrestle with that exact lack of certainty and doubt and... I think what's interesting about a lot of the people, some people are becoming Christians with a lot of certainty and a sort of thunderclap. But I think if you listen to the stories, Anayan Hirsi Ali and your beautiful interview with her, you got more personal and more human and I think more true than almost any other coverage around her. She didn't say, I am suddenly certain of this list of 10 doctrines. She said, this is something, right? I was in despair and now I'm not in despair. And I guess I'd say if what is stopping you is a worry that you have to be certain about it, you can just let that go. That's not what it is. There is much, much room, particularly in the mystical and the contemplative traditions, There's a whole strand of theology called apathetic theology and negative theology, and you know, there's loads of space for that. And I actually think,
well, I think that's why we get on so well, Liz, that we can carry on asking the questions together. Who knows? Let's talk again in 10 years on your podcast when it's still going, and who knows where I'll be.
I really appreciate you reflecting with me today. Thank you so much for being on The Sacred Freddie Sayers.
Thanks, Liz. I enjoyed it.
Well, interviewing interviewers is hard. People who are used to being the one asking the questions, not kind of searching their own mind and soul for what they think about a perspective, is often a bit of a gear change. And Freddie said to me it was really sort of enjoyable but uncomfortable to have the role switched on him. I find it when people interview me. And I also think Freddie's quite a private person. There's not a lot about him online. I was when I was prepping this interview, there's very little outlines of his life, which is quite unusual for journalists. Often journalists are often, not always, pretty comfortable about talking about themselves. They're sort of naturally communicators in that way. And when I meet someone or I'm interviewing someone who I can sense just is temperamentally a bit more private, it's a really interesting thing for me to navigate, because this space is always supposed to be invitational. I think vulnerability is extraordinarily powerful. It helps us understand much better the sort of fragile, complex humanity of someone that we're listening to or meeting or watching or whatever the situation is. It's one of the reasons I ask people about their childhood, because if we're coming to a guest that we might not share their religious beliefs or their political position or their tribe or whatever it is, we can sometimes come into that listening in quite a sort of defended position, expecting to feel annoyed, with this low-level threat reaction often also. And imagining someone as a child can't help, usually, I think, to help us imagine them as slightly vulnerable, as someone who, at least sometime in their life, someone owed care that we would have hoped to have been cared for. So there's little things like that where I'm trying to invite vulnerability in ways that feel, you know, not intrusive, not exploitative, because demanding vulnerability is, I think, really a problem, not a loving way to approach an endeavor of trying to get to know someone at a deep level. And as I've reflected on this and talked to Freddie a bit around it, I think what it's showed up for me is one of my prejudices. And I know that because Freddie is often speaking about things, topics that often get labeled controversial, vaccines, lockdowns, trans issues, you know, Unheard goes near all of those things. And in quite different ways, sometimes depending on who's writing or talking about them. I think he's actually experienced quite a lot of online abuse, trolling, hate, attacks. And I assume those things bounce off people like him, you know, in that ridiculous way we have where we think some people are more vulnerable than others, or some people are more woundable than others, or, you know, in my case, my sort of personal set of prejudicial associations is that, you know, very confident and articulate, privately educated males might not mind about all that, right? Might not worry about all of that. But I don't think that's the case. I think that's one of the many dehumanizing tendencies that are failure to treat each other with particularity and to see the particular person in front of us, not the set of associations that we bring into the conversation. One of the ways that trips us up. Anyway, it left me pensive. Beauty as a sacred value. I do love that it's come up. I really have been waiting for it. And we've had a few artists on and poets. Fewer visual artists, actually, which we should correct. And it's probably just a kind of, you know, blind spot of mine because I'm a wordy kind of person. But no one, I think, has yet said beauty, but I know that there are some very dedicated listeners who will correct me on that if I'm wrong. And it's fascinating to me that it comes from a political journalist. Again, expectations confounded. And I think Freddie has basically, sounds like he's got a sort of almost platonic philosophy. He said this really interesting line, you know, the good and the true and the beautiful are sort of lodestars that are out there in the cosmos as real things, you know, that we need to try and orient ourselves towards. It's just a beautiful, thought-provoking perspective. And he spoke obviously about his family, in which argument and conversation were really key, very different parents. This, and the Ian McGilchrist language comes up again and again. It always has in this podcast, but particularly at the moment. And again, I would direct you to the interview that I did with him, or our sister podcast, Reading Our Times, has got two very useful, much more just explainers of his recent books rather than mine, where I'm always trying to get to the personal. But yeah, the Ian McGilchrist thing with about the right and the left hemispheric forms of attention, and Freddie sort of thinking about himself as someone who's actually uses both and reflects both and doesn't want to just shut down into one or the others. And of course, this, you know, when I asked him about himself as a child, what he did, didn't say something that was like inherently make you feel caring towards. Sorry, he sounded like Just William, but maybe just not so, not about pranks. You know, very confident, very articulate, bit of a monster is how he described himself. And then this boys' private school. And I do try and ask about people's schooling. And that's complicated because in the UK, we're just completely obsessed with class. The like wanting to delineate ourselves upwards or downwards, depending on who we're speaking to. And school is one of those real like classed conversations in the UK. And I have some very dear friends who went to kind of private and public schools, and it's a complicated thing in their identity because people drag all these associations in with it. But when I'm asking about private school or school in Freddie's case, a kind of boys' private school, the worst of me, I'm sure, is doing this, but what I'm not trying to do is go, oh, of course, because you went to that kind of school, you're like that. But instead, ask myself, really, if I had been to that kind of school, what would I be like? Might I be different? And it's this concept I come back to again and again about formation. What are the influences that have led to someone being where they are? If we had had those influences in that life, might we have ended up where they are? You know, what are the big ideas and the communities we've been part of and the ideas that we've been exposed to that make up this complicated picture of a human being in the world? So that's why I ask about school, not as a way of putting people in classed boxes, I hope. Hilariously, I don't know if he said this, but one of the acting roles that Freddie played when he was an actor was Prince William in a TV series about the royals. And it is a very funny image, this kind of young 6'4", you know, he obviously looks like a Winklevoss twin, very commanding presence, dressed up as King Louis. These royal roles coming up again and again, like 6'4" and 3-inch cocks. I think he said something like, I saw that and I thought I shouldn't do that anymore. I just decided, no, acting's not for me. And then pursued this thread about politics and public conversation and polling and trying to get to a sense of what's going on in our common life via kind of hotels and bars. And I love that when I hear people's careers have taken this windy route, you know, we don't all have a sense of what it was, what we want to do. We don't have a clear sense of vocation. Often we're just trying to find the place where our gifts are useful and where we can do something that feels interesting and hopefully meaningful. And Freddie's very honest, you know, that's really only happened maybe in the last 10, 15 years. And then we got to Unheard and some of the kind of sacred cows and presuppositions that people had with each other, both around Brexit and then around COVID. It's left me so thoughtful about, well, you know, talking about COVID and vaccines and all of those debates, I can feel myself as resistant because I'm like, oh no, we had enough of that then. Like, let's not go backwards to that. But I think Freddie's right that it taught us something. It taught us a lot about ourselves and not great stuff. Often some of our tendencies when we are destabilized are not good. And I don't mean that. I don't think anyone came out of it sort of smelling of roses, because uncertainty is so excruciating. there is so much we don't know, and yet are like staying in epistemic uncertainty, staying in the reality of how little we know about almost everything, and still having to make decisions within that reality is so very difficult. And looking back on that time and the way we were all just working with the best information that we had, but we were generally listening to different voices, trusting different people, the power of testimony, the power of kind of peer pressure, essentially adult peer pressure, and how instead of going, this is really difficult and really we don't know, but we're just going to have to make a decision and keep an open heart towards people that made different decisions. I remember doing this. Once we've made a decision, I think we so don't want to be destabilized again into uncertainty that we just lock down, right? And then we, funnily enough, and then we, the temptation to demonize people that have come to a different decision, to harden into a tribal group around that decision is so strong. And, you know, I didn't end up in the same place as Freddie at the time. I don't know where I'd be now. I haven't thought about it for a while. But I think that desire to be someone who questions, who says, wait, it's how much do we know here? And is that true? And what about all these other factors? I do think there's something very beautiful in what Freddie said about what makes life meaningful is other people and time with other people and the loss of that as sort of profoundly dehumanizing. And whether you land on that, that was worth it, that there was a shorter term greater good that required it. It really helped me, I think, to hear that argument from him of the reasoning behind his disquiet at the time about lockdowns. So helpful. And finally, the Christian curious. This comes up with guests a lot. And actually, Freddie sort of asked to talk about it, which was really good. I never want to just, it's so private, isn't it? I never want to trespass. I never want to push someone's boundaries. Make me a terrible journalist in lots of ways. I'm not like a bloodhound for the scoop. I'm really wanting to care for the person that's in front of me. And that felt like a very honest thing to say. I really envy it, but also I'm not actively pursuing it because I'm scared that I might have to be certain on something. And also that lovely thing at the end of like, talk to me in 10 years. And I do think we all, giving each other and ourselves the space to change our minds on things and to move, to just understand that as a part of life and navigate what that means for the places that we belong and the tribes and the people that we love, who we really would like to just agree with us on things because that makes us feel safe. More of that spaciousness. Thank you so much for listening to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield. Our guest today was Freddie Sayers. And our team are Dan Turner and Fiona Hanscom. We're edited by Drew Hawley and our music is by Luke Stanley. The Sacred is a project of the think tank Theos, which I would really encourage you to go check out. Visit our website. There are loads of amazing reports and events. There is a sister podcast called Reading Our Times, which is much more about the big books that are shaping this cultural moment by my wonderful colleague, Nick Spencer. You might really value checking that out. And if you want to get in touch with us, you can do that on all of our normal social media channels. You can find both the Sacred team and me on Instagram, Twitter. I have a Substack called More Fully Alive, which you can find at Substack. It's an email newsletter. And I have a book coming out in May, also called Fully Alive, which you could pre-order now if you so wished. Thank you so much for listening, and I will speak to you next time. Mm-hmm.